Post Malone, you played guitar on his whole country record.
Mm-hmm. I really just heard that.
Played the Hole in the Bottle solo. Kelsey Ballerini. Fast Car, Luke Combs.
Sometimes when someone says country, it's like, you mean full booger eater?
You're a big watch guy. Any cool, affordable watches?
I have the exact same mentality about watches that I do guitars and amps, and it's this.
Today's episode is sponsored by Gator Cases. Guitarists, like any other musician, value the advantages of proper protection for their gear. Guitars, amps, effects, and accessories all need safe transport and storage. Luckily, Gator's got you covered.
ACM guitarist of the year, Derek Wells. There's something about your lineage of playing guitar that I just can't wrap my head around.
Okay.
You kind of started playing at 17, 18.
Yeah.
Relatively late in life.
Yeah.
So you just hunkered down in your dad's basement and did what? How did you figure out?
Done your homework here.
How did you figure out how to play the instrument at that age? What did you have as a resource?
Well, I mean, that's... So I think the fair thing to say is that, like, you know, it's not like I had never touched one. I mean, my dad's a guitar player. And, you know, there were definitely times as a young kid that, like, I would go in his music room out of boredom and kind of pick one up and just, like, lay my hands on it. But, you know, if he ever came in and tried to, like, show me anything, it's like probably like a little bit of embarrassment, like just normal kid stuff, like, or not thinking your dad's cool or whatever. But,
yeah.
Like, I was just like, I'm just bored. I don't want to do this really. And so when I was like 16, my cousin had just gotten like way into drums. And he really is the one that convinced me to like borrow some stuff from your dad and come over to my garage and like, let's just like, you know, jam or whatever. I don't even know if we called it that. And it was like all like just riff stuff. It was like band, like he loved like 311 was like his favorite band. And so, you know, it was just like so like primitively sounding it out. But some of that music is, you know.
Yeah, give me a little bit.
You know, there's like, it's like some of that stuff, like that 311 stuff was, and then, or it was just riffs, you know. It was just that kind of stuff. And like really cool, amazingly written songs, like awesome sounds and everything. But it did kind of, at least the way my brain works, it lended itself to kind of being able to stumble into it. You know, you weren't, you know, nowhere in my brain at all was I beginning to think about minors or major sevens or anything like that. And so it just kind of started there. And, you know, at that point, that made me kind of listen to music in general in a different way. Because I can't really say that I had ever been like a music guy until then. You know, I've said in like other interviews before, like my parents are, you know, musicians, and it was very much work in our house. Like we didn't listen to music recreationally. Like I see your stack of records. Like my dad didn't like put the Beatles on vinyl on the weekends and chill out. Like they were like working on music. It was a job. So the bug didn't really get me. You know, I still went to college. Started college and was going to get a normal job. I did not.
You were going to go into like, journalism.
Print journalism. Yeah, print journalism. And then, you know, that wasn't working out. And I just, this part had just intensified. Like it was just, it had, you know, I was up in my dorm and it was the first time I'd really had like free time. I played a lot of sports as a kid and through high school, and it like that was my extracurriculars. And then, you know, I screwed around on guitar on Saturdays with my cousin, and that was kind of the extent of it. But I got up there to college and I was in my dorm, and it just became this thing that I just was doing all day. Like I just would not put it down, you know. And you know, it was also the time in our history where like Napster existed. And we were all too stupid to know that, you know, I was like, we were just anything, you know. And then things like LimeWire came around, and then that was a whole other thing because I could watch videos. I could pull up a 311 video and see where Tim Mahoney was playing the parts on the guitar, and like, oh, or like Dave Matthews, like whatever. Which I'm a visual person also, so like that really unlocked something in like my desire and like my arc in playing the instrument. And so yeah, after a couple semesters I was like, screw this, I'm gonna play guitar. Like I love it so I was just obsessed with it.
Weren't your parents almost not that encouraging of it? Like
they were terrified,
but they were musicians. Isn't that weird?
Well, I know we have had these conversations. It's like in hindsight, you know, I mean, they know how tough the business is, you know, very much so. And I think that they were smart to, you know, acknowledge or make me, you know, understand how late of a start I was getting. You know, they came to town and they've had their paths that they have, but they both, you know, my dad was playing guitar when he's like 4 years old.
Yeah.
You know, I also think that they understandably probably had a fear that like, well, Derek's maybe a little lost. College isn't working out. Like maybe he just thinks this is going to be easy. And so I think, you know, really they were scared, yes, but I think they also just wanted me to know like how far away I was. And you know, that really was the benefit of growing up. How I grew up was, you know, I actually had a very real understanding of how good you had to be, because I've watched my dad play guitar and he's great. And, you know, still watched him have ups and downs in his career as a sideman, you know, as a guitar player, and, you know, lose gigs and go from this thing to this thing and whatever. And so, you know, I knew I wasn't ready at all. Like, that was very clear to me. So, you know, long answer to your question, in that period when I came home and was living in the basement there, I had a job waiting tables. There was a restaurant in town back then called The Cooker in Green Hills. It doesn't exist anymore. And a buddy of mine got me a job there. And I mean, I did nothing but go to work to wait tables and come back and play guitar in the basement. I mean, it didn't matter if I wasn't at The Cooker, I was playing guitar. I didn't have a girlfriend. I didn't hang out with friends. Like, all of my friends were like in college at that time. And I was just trying to prove to their parents, like, I wasn't going to be a loser, you know, because they were all like, so you dropped out of college, huh? Oh, well, what do you think you're going to do? And I'm like, well, I'm waiting tables and playing guitar. And they were like, oh, you could see it on their face.
Even in your musical family, that still felt like a... not a great path.
Yeah, for sure. And, but what I started to do, I mean, I would say after a few months, my parents did, they came around relatively quickly, and they were like, okay, well, we see the hours you're logging. If you're serious, here are some things you should be working on. One of those being like, go buy the Nashville Number System book. And so that was a big habit for me was, I would go probably every week, I'd say every week, when the new records came out. And I would go to Walmart, you know, we didn't have iTunes. I'd go to Walmart and I would buy like a contemporary or classic country record, like something you would hear on country radio. And then I would buy like a pop or rock record, like something that I thought was just cool from like an Incubus record or something. And I would just try my best to like learn those records cover to cover. And I was not good enough. But I was practicing all these things at once. I was like trying to teach myself how to write the charts. I was trying to learn these voicings. You know, I was becoming a soloist really for kind of the first time. Everything until then had just been like playing riffs, you know? And you know, that was the thing, man. That was, you know, and it was a year and a half or 2 years of that. And nothing else.
But did you have the sense like, because I can't figure it out with you. Like, did you have the sense like, okay, I've got to learn the five pentatonic boxes. I've got to learn all my triads up the neck. Like, how did you develop?
I still don't know that.
But maybe. I feel like sometimes that knowledge just organizes the fretboard.
Sure.
How do you visualize the fretboard in your head? Or do you? Or do you just know it so well that you just know what to do when?
That's a good question.
Do you picture?
That's a good question. My dad's the same way. It sounds so funny, man. It's like, it's just in my brain, it's just connecting dots. It's like, first off, because I went so hard in the number system at that age and like while I was like learning, like, man, people speaking notes like actually messes me up. Like if anybody were to hand me like a chord chart with like letters, I'm like,
I
can't do it. You know, and I also was also playing a lot of acoustic back then. My dad had very wisely told me like, hey, stay up on your acoustic playing. Like, you know, you, that could be like a thing. That's another skill, you know, to be a really good acoustic player is different than playing electric. And, you know, so a lot of capo usage and all that kind of stuff. And so like, especially when I'm using a capo and someone's like, you know, play the D, and it's like, it's all shapes and intervals for me. And so, yeah, like when I think about, you know, soloing, I guess is maybe the word. It's like, you know, I just kind of know where the A's are, you know, and it's, for me, it's just, it's like really connecting. It's this weird, you know, amalgamation of like licks that I just learned from ear and like learned to play them in the different keys and then connecting those dots. And, you know, I guess the best way I can describe it is just like muscle, like largely muscle memory.
Yeah.
At this point, there is nothing cerebral about it for sure. Like I said, at least in how I connect the notes, yeah, you know, I definitely approach the recording of guitar very cerebrally. And I like to craft parts, but yeah, I don't know, which is, coincidentally, you know, I get asked a lot, like, you know, do you ever give lessons? Like, you know, would you? And I'm like, man, I can't. There's probably no one worse than me to get. I like truly don't know. It's just years and years of doing it and figuring it out my way. And like I said, a lot of ear stuff.
Wait, but when you would practice the Nashville number system, like what did that mean? So you bought this book, mm-hmm. you figured out the scale degrees were connected to numbers, and then you would basically, would you play progressions and go through charts and just change the key but look at the numbers? Like how would you practice this to get really competent?
Well, a lot of it was just, like I would say, buying those new records and then just trying to write the chart. Because, you know, inevitably, just things like, you know, whatever... If you, you know, if you're in G and playing, you know, this D chord, you know, which, you know, it would be a 5/7 if you're in the key of G or whatever. It's like, even just that stuff was like, I was having to learn that real time. Like, I can't overstate, like, I knew nothing. And so.
That's what I don't get, how you figure this out. How do you put these pieces together?
Well, I would say two things. I think genetics really helped me close the gap. And, a lot of trial and error. I mean, that's the, I'm stubborn. You know, I would sit there and rewind and rewind over and over and over and over and over. And that was, you know, and not to mention like fully say, like, if I got really hung up, I could usually go grab my pops and be like, what is he do? Like, what is this? It's like, I know it with a, I mean, there's a note I'm like, I could hear. I'm like, there's a note that I'm not getting. Like there's something. And, you know, oftentimes he would be like, well, yeah, he's, you know, he's, it's like an A chord, but he's grabbing this note in the bottom of it too. You know, it's like a 4/6 or whatever. And I'm like, oh, but in writing out the charts, and again, I'm a visual learner, I started to see the patterns like in the songs, and you start to just realize like, oh yeah, it's that thing again. Oh, it's the way he walks down. Oh, it's that thing again. It's that thing again. And something about the way my brain works, just that all started to make sense to me. It was just like, you see, there's a 5/7 in this and a 5/7 in his, but they're not okay. But they're not, it's, that's not always a 5/7. If I'm in C, oh, it's this, you know, and like whatever. Yeah. And you, figuring that kind of stuff out. And so, yeah, I mean, I think, like I said, just a combination of, you know, definitely having the phone a friend, like I could go grab some, like my dad or my mom or my stepdad, all talented musicians, and I could go grab them and be like, I can't, like, what am I doing wrong? I know this is the notes, but I'm missing a note or something. And they could usually help me out with a voicing situation, or I would just, over, and I would just rewind it. I mean, just like an idiot, like wait, like that. I mean, and then okay, and then writing it down and finding my ways to, like, you know, just remember that. I mean, it was just stupid.
So, do you, like, if you're on a session and someone's like, all right, we're going to do, I don't know what, like a solo in the key of A, like something chicken picking style-esque. Mm-hmm. So you're thinking about all the roots, and then, the like, could you almost demonstrate something of what you would think about to compose a solo with the way you think about it? So you said you would find the roots of all the A's. That's where you start, obviously.
Yeah, well,
and
that,
then you fill in the gaps around that.
Yeah, that's how it started, and then, like, you know, obviously the part is also then just like years and years and years and years and years of doing this now. So that's the muscle memory part for me, you know? And so, like, you know, if you were, I mean, I don't know, like, say, and then a five, you know, it's like, yeah. You know, or whatever, and then, you know, and then it'd be like, well, let me, okay, so let me actually think about the progression I'm gonna play. So, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's super rudimentary, but like, that's just how my brain thinks of it. And then if I, and again, it's like so much of it now is just muscle memory and like figuring out the blue notes in between everything. And that's the stuff too, that just takes like years and years and years of figuring out. Like, I now know the verbiage for like a major scale versus a minor scale. But when you're a kid, or when you're learning, it doesn't have to be a kid. For me, when I was learning, it was like, yeah, if I'm playing those progressions, why does not sound that cool to me?
Yeah.
And then realizing, like, oh, that's more the thing. It's that note. It's not
the major.
Not so much that, yeah.
That's the minor one.
And then it's just putting it all together, you know, connecting the dots. And then, like I said, like learning licks, like, you know, learning Brent Mason licks, you know, stuff like that. And then I would learn a lick, and then I would learn it in every key, or at least as best I could, in like all the different keys, and being like, okay, here's a lick that, he, you know, they played an A in this, but like, what does it sound like in G? You know, I mean, as stupid as it sounds, but just going like, and just knowing like, oh yeah, okay, that lick works in all these different keys. You know, that little bend thing works. I mean, I'd say I'm oversimplifying it, but I don't even think I can simplify it enough. It was so rudimentary.
Yeah. How competent were you? Because there's the story where you got like your first gig, you were subbing for someone.
Oh God. Yeah.
And your mom gave you this piece of advice, I think, where she was like, whatever you do, do not memorize these songs.
Yeah.
Write the charts. The thing to me is, for me, I almost think if I was starting out, it would have been easier to have memorized them because I wouldn't have been able to have read charts. Like, I wouldn't have known how to do that, right? So you must have had some ability or something you were practicing to be able to be really competent reading the charts.
Well, I was,
right?
I was doing them all the time. I mean, that was, like I said, I mean, I was just doing them, you know, basically every week I was charting two records.
Yeah.
You know, as best I could, especially in the beginning, I'm sure many of those charts were wrong. But like, I was just like rumbling, stumbling, bumbling my way through it. But yeah, by that time, that thing you're talking about, and I kind of got this opportunity to go to this gig, it's like, I was reading them, you know, just good enough to kind of be dangerous. And she was right. Like, it was short notice, and there was no way I was going to memorize 75 minutes of music, you know, and all the parts and all the things. And like, you know, some people make a lot of notes on their set list. It's like, I had my book of charts, man. And I'm still that way. Like, I'll write charts for gig, you know, I mean, any gig I do, I'll write a chart. I don't care what, I have to have a chart. But oftentimes, like, just turning the chart and seeing it, and I go, oh, I know how this song goes. But there's something about it that cues my memory of the way. Or I'll, you know, kind of, I call it, you know, flash memorize, you know, I'll look at the chart and remind myself of the intro and the verse. And then it's just the feel. And then I glance up again. Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And then, oh yeah, there's a bridge. Okay, cool. But I'm not like counting the bars, reading it, you know, it's more, like I said, like a flash memory of just the structure of the thing.
So when you finally, you bounced around a couple of gigs and then you became the guitar player for Josh Turner, but you were also the band leader. What other, you know, responsibilities did you have as band leader at that time in your career?
Well, that was tough too, because I got that gig, because the guitar player had left to go do another gig, and that guy had been the band leader. And, you know, I think more than anything, Josh just kind of felt like his lead guitar player needed to be the band leader. And so when I first joined, there just kind of wasn't one. And I didn't know any of the dynamic of anything, you know. I was just, again, trying to play guitar. And again, like, when I got that gig with Josh, I was just barely enough.
Yeah.
Barely good enough to do that. I mean, like, I'm like,
who told you that? Why did you feel that way?
Oh, I just remember. I just remember. I mean, I know how
you think
it felt.
They knew that, or that was just something you were dealing with yourself.
Well, who knows? That's a great question. I mean, what I mean is, like, I was just competent enough to learn the parts and recreate them pretty well, but there was not going to be a lot of improvisation or, like, you know, elaboration. I mean, I certainly wasn't thinking I could make anything better or make it my own. It was like, I have to play this like the record, because this is all I know how to do. And I'm sure at the beginning I was playing some of the solos wrong. I'm sure I was, you know. But yeah, I had been there like right at a year. Like, I'd been there like 8 or 9 months. And he just kind of called me on the phone. I was like, you know, I was hoping you'd, you know, get settled in, because, you know, I feel like you and I communicate pretty well, and would you want to, you know, and it's like, I was like, oh, sure, what does that mean? You know, I remember kind of asking my parents, like, so Josh just made me his band leader. Like, what is that? What am I supposed to do? And largely it just was kind of, you know, it ended up being like a point of communication for everybody. And maybe at the most too, like, some quality control, just somebody other than him to make sure people were playing the parts right from the record.
But you say you didn't even know what your parts were. So how were you the guy for the job?
That's a great question, man. If he were here, maybe he could answer that.
No, but you had to have brought something to it, or you had to have something that you were doing right.
Well, I mean, I think by that time, I was playing that gig pretty well.
Yeah.
And Josh, you know, there's a lot of rules of thinking in this, but he was a guy that really liked it like the record every night. He wanted to hear the parts from the record every night. That's what he wanted. He didn't want you to change up the solos. He wanted the verse. Like, that was how he liked it. And he sang it the same way every night. Never deviated. He told the same jokes every night. But that was a comfort level for him. And I think largely he noticed that about me, that I was doing everything, you know, that they could count, you know, you set your watch to me kind of thing. And he liked that. And so, yeah, early on, you know, some of what I was doing was, you know, calling a few people to the carpet on, like, hey, you know, I'm like, been back listening to the record again, and the bass part's actually this, like, you know, and that's kind of what makes the chorus feel the way it feels. I think that's where, you know, if you're asking me a skill set, coming fresh off of that period of a couple years of dissecting records and just like listening intently, like all the time, zoning in, it developed that part of my brain to be like, hey, so, you know I'm playing the part from this record. Why does it feel weird? Oh, the kick, that's not the right kick pattern. And so I think, you know, that probably early on would have been, even though he may or may not have realized that at the time, that was probably the real skill set I brought early, was bringing some people back to like, hey, I know you were playing a couple of these songs for like a year and a half before I got here, but the bass part's actually this.
Yeah.
That's what it does on the, you know, and I think that's why it feels weird to him when we're in the verses, because you're not doing the thing that's on the record, and, you know. And then, you know, I eventually got really comfortable, and he was really encouraging, and his management at the time was very encouraging to me as a young, I mean, and it was weird. Look, I was 21, and some of those dudes, and there was a guy in the band at that time that was literally 30 years older than me. And it was weird to go to that guy and be like, you know, you're playing this thing wrong. You know, it was weird. But everyone was really receptive and kind, and management backed me up and Josh backed me up. And my parents were such a good resource. You know, I remember like having a conversation from some gig out somewhere, because Josh was concerned that this one song kept kind of speeding up. And my dad was like, are you guys playing to a click out there? And I was like, no. And he's like, yeah, you got to get that happening, you know? And it was like, oh.
So then was that your job to build a rig to figure out how to get click going?
Yeah, but I mean, dude, back then there was no rig. No one was running tracks. There wasn't a rig.
Yeah, yeah.
Back in the aughts, it was like, hey, the drummer has a click that he's starting the songs with.
And that's it.
Can we send that to everybody and just leave it on the whole song?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I remember some of those conversations where it's like, well, he's pulling against us. It's like, well, we got to hold it. Like, oh, this is the gig, you know. So, yeah, just stuff like that. And then eventually, yes, we did get into some very primitive track running. And I remember that was all built around this. He had this one song that was going to be a single. What was the title of the song? It was actually a song that Chris Stapleton wrote.
Oh, Your Man.
No. It was a duet with Trisha Yearwood. It was called Another Try.
Another Try.
Long story short, it didn't end up being the single they wanted to, but they thought it was going to be this big moment song for him, and it had all these strings on it. And I remember like having some conversations with the manager, and then ultimately with Josh's producer, Frank Rogers, who's now become a real friend of mine, and just being like, I feel like we're not doing this song justice if we don't have the strings. It just feels like it's that kind of record. And everyone had agreed, and at that point they allowed me to go out and build a track screen, and it was literally like an ADAT or like a Lesis HD hard drive machine, and we literally like recorded the tracks into it, and like all you could do was push play back on it. And because no one was building road rig. Like back then, Pro Tools was still pretty expensive. There weren't mobile. The most advanced mobile like IO we had back then was an Mbox. Like that wasn't something you were going to use out on the road. And so, you know, built that kind of primitive thing. And that was my kind of first foray into running tracks live, which was a whole other thing that we got into. But that was kind of the gig I did. And then, yeah, when we get a new record, I'd kind of be in charge of, you know, he knew I was going to learn it. I was going to know it better than him.
Yeah.
It was just kind of making sure everybody else did too, you know?
So then you decide to come off the road after doing that gig for like 5 years, and you go, okay, I need to become a session musician. That's the next step.
Yeah.
And I've heard you tell the story about being on a session early, and something wasn't happening with your headphones.
Mm-hmm.
So the session kicks off and you're like, oh, I can't hear anything. So you stop the session and some guy like chews you out.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And he's like, don't ever do that ever again. What is that about? Cause I've also been on gigs where someone like really senior chews you out for something and it just kills your whole vibe. And it's like, what is that energy or what is that about on a session? Isn't that the worst thing you can do?
Yeah.
Something like that.
It's pretty tough. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty tough. You know, it's a tough thing, man. Like the only thing I can equate, you know, playing sessions to is, you know, any version of a major league sport, right? And, you know, meaning like, you know, you rarely end up there by accident. And you've probably had to be put through some version of some paces before you even get in the room. But, you know, at the end of the day, everyone's got their own job to do. And if, you know, your inability to do your job is hindering somebody else's ability to do their job, or if they feel that way,
they can be.
And I mean, I think that, you know, there's a broader conversation of how to handle that. What I will say is I remember the guys on both sides of the table for me, because I was a session idiot also. Like when I started playing on some sessions, the same thing as playing the road, like I was just barely good enough to be playing some sessions. And even my chart, like at that point, really the only charts I'd ever read were my own. And so getting into that world and started getting like shorthand charts from other people and realizing like, Like, I remember there was a guy, I love him to death. His name's John Willis. I worked with him for years. He's awesome. He's an amazing musician. But his charts wouldn't even say, like, verse, chorus. He had this weird, he still does it. He had this weird, like, lines thing where it was like one line was a verse and two lines was a chorus and three lines was a, and, you know, just repeats and first endings and DSs and codas and all this stuff. And even just people feeling bars, like in fast bars versus slow bars and all that kind of stuff. And it's like, there were so many hurdles. And I think what my point was is like, I definitely remember the guys who were assholes about it.
Yeah.
And I definitely remember the guys who like kind of quietly came over to me in between takes and was like, hey man, you know, we're kind of playing all those four chords like major sevens. What you're doing is cool, but maybe just check it out. And I'm like, oh yeah.
Yeah.
And the kind of helping hand guys instead of the guys that are like, hey, new kid, you're fucking up my vibe over here.
Were you just not afraid to suck, though? Or you just thought...
Oh, terrified.
So I don't get how you had the confidence to go into these rooms. Or what was the option? You had no other alternative.
Well, I think for me, the option is like, what are you going to do? Say no?
Yeah.
Like someone says, hey, man, would you come do this session? Knowing I want to do sessions, what am I going to say? Like... No, ask me again in 6 months. It was like, okay. And listen, man, no bones about it. Like, I got my ass whipped a lot. And I think that in hindsight, like, there's no doubt in my mind, I probably had some sessions that they had to replace me after the fact. Like, no doubt in my mind. But what I'm thankful for is that, one, any of those embarrassing moments happened at such small scales or in such kind of like whatever the opposite of high profile is, like such low profile incidents that I was able to recover. Like they weren't.
Yeah. How'd you not have your career ruined before you got out of the gate?
Yeah. Yeah. Cause YouTube wasn't a thing, you know, yeah. But my stumbles were on small scales and I just always had the mentality of like, when I did have a hiccup or an embarrassing moment on a session, I was just like, I am going to make sure that never happens to me again. Like I would go back and just obsess over that moment or that, like, you know, that like idiot. He kept saying that major seven and I thought they were talking about dominant, like, and just figuring out that like I knew how to play a major seven in every part of the because I was not going to be embarrassed in the same way again, or like getting called out for my being out of tune or something and just being like that will never happen to me, like I will obsess over my tuning. And that's again the kind of stubborn obsessive part of me that, you know, helped me come out. Because yeah, like flat out the one thing I would have always said about that era of my life was like, if you had hired me on a session and then you hired me a month later, I would have been 150% times better than the guy you hired the month before.
Yeah.
Like, just period. Because I was going to give a shit that hard.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's not a lot you can do in preparation for sessions, which I think is the other hardest thing because, you know, again, another sports analogy is like, it's easy to go hit 1,000 balls in the batting cage. And like, yeah, maybe you turn that thing up and you can hit a 100-mile-an-hour fastball. But man, that is not the same thing as a pitcher staring you down and like both literally and figuratively throwing you curveballs. Like you may think you know how to play a song really well or like play good parts or whatever until you play it once and the writer or the artist goes, man, I'm not hearing it like that at all. Like it's supposed to be more this or this or this. And then your ability to pivot and be like, well, what am I supposed to change? I mean, that's the only way I hear this song. Like, what am I supposed to change? And like, that's the stuff that's like the on-the-job experience that, again, I was just so lucky that I, you know, the times I had missteps, they weren't super public. And or I was around people gracious enough to give me another chance. And I really don't know another way to... I just told somebody this week, I was at Coachella, I was talking to somebody, and I was like, man... There were several times in my career that a stiff breeze could have ruined me.
Yeah.
I felt like I was so scraping the guardrail so hard that like it's a miracle that I you know, pulled it out and survived, you know.
Yeah, right, right. Okay, I've got some specific sessions to ask you about. Okay. Now that you've, like, you know, you've gone through the early stages of being rough.
Yeah.
Now you're getting it together. Really recently, post Malone, you played guitar on his whole country record.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Talk about the song "I Had Some Help." Do you remember recording that song? How that did was the riff? Did you come up with that guitar riff?
Yeah,
intro riff, or how did that song come together?
Yeah, I did. And that's a cool, you know, that's a cool. It's a good segue to all this because, you know, I've told people there's a part of the recording process that can be really cerebral to me, and I definitely think, you know, in terms of like how everything fits, but at the end of the day, and it's always been this way, start to finish, it's like, all I can really do is listen to the song that you play for me in whatever version it is and hope that I hear something, like that it's a, like a melody comes to my mind or there's something that I feel. And, you know, anyone that's ever done a session with me would tell you, if they paid attention, is just that, like, the song gets done and I've got my chart and I go, okay, cool. And I will walk out and just sit down and I'll just immediately start playing something. Especially if I think there's unoccupied real estate. I mean, it's one thing if they play us something and you're like, there's going to be this fiddle thing from the top or whatever. It's like, okay, okay. But if it's open real estate, I mean, I really believe that that's part of my job is to like create parts.
Come up with a hook or something notable.
And yeah, that was just one of those. I heard it and we walked out there and, you know, his things were late at night. It was the middle of the night. So it's probably just a lot of like instinct and muscle memory. But I really just heard that. And I started playing that and, you know, immediately, and this is what you hope, this is what you always hope happens. You go out there and you start playing something like that. And what you hope is the control room goes, yo, that's it. That's the thing. Hey, Derek's on it. Like, come to him. And that's what it was. And so really quickly, you know, Brian Sutton, they're like, hey, Sutton, can you learn? It'd be cool if y'all played it together, you know? And then they turned him up louder in the mix. No, no, but that is how that thing came apart. And it is, it's just one of those, it's a, you know, it's a kind of Tom, I was like Tom Petty kind of driving thing, like the spirit of it. And, you know, and then the hook, the ba-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na, that was actually something one of the producers or post himself, some combination of the control room started singing that thing back to us. And then it was like, okay. And I think I might have changed like one note maybe, but then it becomes like, okay, well, let's all play it. Let's Bastille play it and fiddle play it and like everybody. And that's the cool kind of synergistic thing that you still get from tracking a record with a full band like that, where it's like everybody sort of, oh, that is cool. Okay, I'll follow that. Okay, what if we change it this one thing? And then, you know, stacking that with a couple cool sounds or whatever. But it, yeah, that thing, that rolling picking thing, it was just like, I kind of heard it in my head and I just went out there and sat down and started doing that thing.
What was on the recording? Was it just strumming acoustic?
Yeah, it was just like an iPhone. Like they were singing into an iPhone, kind of like strumming along thing.
So it needed something to kick the song.
Well, I felt like it, you know, needed something there. And even then, you know, I'm not going to say I had like the grand vision of like, hey, it's going to start with just this guitar thing. And then the drums come in. Like that's production and post, you know, he was way. But again, that's the thing is, if you're lucky enough to go out there and get on something that feels like a vibe, well, we've got the best musicians in the world. And then they all adjust that, you know, and it's like what Aaron kind of saving the half drum groove thing until we get to the verse where he starts playing the full time. It's like all that stuff is just, everyone's just reacting to everyone else. So that was one of those moments where I was just, you know, dumb luck. I walked out there and was like, this feels like a thing. And, you know, and then of course you nowadays too, you start going like, wait, is that something else? Like, is that, you know, is that already on it? You know, but we all were like, nah, it's a fuse. It's just a thing.
Is this going to go down as one of your most iconic intros? I don't know. This song is massive, right?
I mean, yeah. I mean, I'd say probably like by the numbers, it probably is.
Yeah. Wait, play one more time. Can you just show one more time? It's so good.
Well, it's so simple. I mean, it's just cowboy chords, you know, but yeah, I think,
thank you.
It's just that
it's
over and
perfect,
over.
It's perfect, though, isn't it? It's exactly what needs to be there.
Well, you know, I mean, luckily it ended up being that way, you know. And then I think in the chorus, it evolves into some sort of more open version. I think I was adding a little more of like the 16th in it without the pauses, you know. But I mean, again, that's some of the part that's not super cerebral. Like, it's just energy at that point. You're just getting a vibe for it, you know.
You played the Hole in the Bottle solo for Kelsey Ballerini.
Yeah.
So when you're in the recording session, is it charted like, okay, solo, and then does it say we're thinking something Brent Mason, or do you just listen to it and you go, oh, this needs like a chicken pick and ripper kind of thing?
Well, no,
like,
that
how
was,
did that come together?
So that was one that so Jesse Frazier produced that song for Kelsey, and Jesse's amazing. He's brilliant. And he's such a vibe guy. And he had like a sample, like something from Splice or some sample pack that was really filtered down. And it was like a like pretty close version of that intro bit. Something like that. And then it went to the five, and I remember like him saying like, hey, we think this can be that kind of guitar thing. It can be old timey and country. But these are all just samples I drug in, you know, and there were some quirky licks and stuff. And he was like, but it just needs to be like a real guy. And I remember kind of messing around with that. And then I got to the, remember how it goes down. I have the worst musical memory, but like my short-term memory is like so good. Like I'll hear like, but cool. And then an hour later it's gone. But,
that sounds right.
And I remember doing that as just like a kind of a Jerry Reed thing. And Jesse was like, yeah, all of that stuff. Right.
That sounds exactly right.
And so, So again, that was just me taking the thing. And then once I knew, like, there's always this joke about, like, people will give a reference. And it's like, yeah, but did they mean it? And, you know, oftentimes it's like, you know, there's levels to all this stuff. So when anyone says, like, it can be more country or it can be more R&B or it can, don't be afraid to make it rock. It's like, well, there's still levels of that. And I believe that that's a big part of what I'm there to do is, like, when someone says, hey, this can rock, why don't go immediately to Pantera? Like, there's some awareness of going like, okay, well, there's like 8 degrees of rocking. And based on the song and what it's saying and the other instrumentation and possibly the body of work of this individual, I'm going to filter the term rock into what I mean. And so sometimes when someone says country, it's like, well, how, you know, to use it, we were talking about Dan Huff earlier, to use a Dan Huff expression, it's like, you mean full booger eater?
Yeah.
And I did know when I got to that, when they lit up, I was like, oh, they mean it. And so from that point, I knew, I was like, oh, I can go full idiot here.
Full chicken
and,
pit.
Yeah, and yeah, do the yeah, thing. Yeah. And so, yeah, by the time we got to the solo, it was like, and I actually think I had done a couple like iterations of it going down. And again, kind of just testing
what do you mean,
the water.
Like they gave you a couple passes to get.
Well,
the
no,
solo,
like while we were playing the track, I think a couple times I had just like, you know, freeballed a solo or like, you know, in the middle of the tracking takes. And again, that's me kind of testing the waters and just kind of looking through the control room glass and being like, all right, have I pushed it too far now? You know, are they? And I think there was a point when they probably, you know, either Kelsey or Jesse had said like, hey, we love the solo ideas. And I was like, okay, cool. Well, I'll do this rhythm track. I'll come back to it. But that's cool because that's how I'm thinking of it, like that kind of guy. And then from there, you know, once we got the base of the track down and they wanted me to do it, you know, for me, there's two ways solos happen. It's like, there's always, the first couple are always what I call throw and paint. And, you know, like, man, you get lucky sometimes. You do it a lot. And, like, sometimes you throw out one or two, and one of those first two ones are, they just have the spirit and the vibes right. But oftentimes for me, I'll say is, like, I throw paint until I get one that felt like it's almost what I wanted to do. And then I'll take a couple minutes and refine on that. And I do remember this feeling like one where, you know, and I used to do this stupid little, I used to do this as an exercise. I would sit around and I would just go up. You know, just that kind of thing over and over. And I think that's just, I think when they did it, it was probably like I'd already played a couple ideas and I went to the. And then what did I do? Right? I do that because it goes to the A.
Yeah.
And then does it go to
the. You do the sixth, I think, sliding up right?
Oh, yeah, I know. Oh.
Yes.
And again, like that's, you know, back to the muscle memory thing. It's like, that's just some lick I learned years ago in probably in a different key, you know. And then that was one of those basement hours where I was like, oh, I can play it in A too. Just moving it all up and down the fretboard. So yeah, so muscle memory. Right. And then what do I do? Something like that. And then what I go? Something like that. Does that sound right?
That's been, really close. That sounds really close.
Yeah.
Wait. So hold on. There's a couple things here to break down. First of all, that sort of exercise.
I haven't thought about this in forever.
Can you do that? What that exercise is, like, a little slower? Like, what was that exercise that sort of kicked the? You said it was an exercise that you started that kicks the solo off.
Well, yeah.
Like, what is that exercise?
Well, man, it was just something I don't know. It's not something I learned. I think again, at some point in my just rudimentary way of trying to learn how to play guitar. You know, like I said, when I would learn a lick from somebody else, I would just try really hard to like figure out how to play that lick in other places. And then especially when you get into real country guitar playing, you start like learning how to chicken pick and you dive into Brent and everybody that did that so great and JT, I mean, all these people. You start realizing how fun the open strings all are, you know, and you get all these cool little dissonant things that happen from all the open strings. And I mean, who knows where the first time I did something like that, but. So that's what I'm doing. And I mean, you can kind of see them. And the other part of that, that's kind of a trick is like, I'm actually snapping that. I'm like grabbing it between my.
How are you getting the Les Paul to sound like this? You play with 11s, right? Does that help on a Les Paul?
Yeah, I think it's just kind of how I set. Well, we talked about these pickups earlier.
Yeah.
I can't really talk about. We talked about these pickups.
Yeah, earlier.
So that's part of it. But man, that's probably just the way I set my amp. I don't know. It's probably just the way I set my amp. But yeah. So yeah, just. And then again, we talked about like the muscle memory of the changes, like a 1 to a 4 or a 1 to a 5. And you know, so it was a, you know, which all that would have been, you know.
Yep.
But yeah, that little thing. And so I think I'd probably started out playing it on an E and then was like, how could I play it in A, which is easy. And then if you wanted to, something like that, you know, you could move. But I would do that kind of stuff and just try to move it all around, you know.
And then when you go up, you really get kind of Brent-y. So
that's, again, same kind of like lick stuff. So, you know, Brent always played these cool, because he'd play it with a B bender, but these kind of. You know, those kinds of things. And so, you know, those kind of things. And so I think Who's Cheating Who, the...
Yeah.
That one solo goes... He goes... And then he goes... So, you know, the minute I was able to sound that out, whatever part of my life I did all that, I was like, oh, I got to figure out how to play this in all the key. You know, it's that thing again. So, and then again, after years, that just becomes muscle memory. But that's just a, you know. And then that's the, when it gets into the double stop thing, that's muscle memory. That's not a lick. That's just kind of stumbling downstairs, you know. And then, yeah, and then again, you learn some of these, like, turnarounds, you know, a 2 to a 5 or a 5 to a 1, and that I always enjoyed that little 5 to a 1 turnaround thing is just something that I feel like is kind of like public domain.
Anybody can grab that. Yeah. That's there for you to grab.
Yeah, it's just, it's like, that's a lick that people have been playing since Hank Gart, like, whatever.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's anybody. It's just a 5 to a 1 turnaround thing. But yeah, so I think I probably had some of it started and then refined the back half for a little bit, or played the back half till I got it right or something like that. And then, yeah, as is the life, it's like, it was just another thing I did that day. It was like, then we played, like, 3 more songs. It was like,
yeah.
And you thought, like, oh, that was fun. But
there was,
know,
kind of a moment when that song came out where everybody was learning the solo on social media, wasn't there? And, like, everybody was posting it.
Well, Jesse Fraser told me that, like, they partly picked it as a single because it had gotten, like, it was, like, and this was still early TikTok. Yeah. It was, like...
The solo was, like, kind of going
everyone
viral.
Was, yeah. Like, I remember, like, Brad Paisley posted a video playing it or whatever. Yeah, and it was, like... And so funny to me to get, you know, again, when you live in a town with guys like Brent or Brad Paisley or JT Kornfloss, who passed away now, but was like one of my heroes, and guys like Keith Urban, where it's like so funny to me that, like, that, like, me doing this impression of my guitar heroes, it became a thing.
It doesn't really sound like them, though. It kind of, like, well, it sounds influenced by them, but it doesn't, like, to me, people were like, oh, this sounds just like Brad Paisley. And I was like, it doesn't sound anything like Brad Paisley. It's a totally different.
Well, that's that. Yeah. Sound. I mean, that's, and I think that's what you choose to know. I actually had this conversation with Brent Mason recently because me and him do, you know, good amount of work together. And I was telling him, I was like, man, you know, for years when I was with him or certain other guys, I would just never even get a Telecaster out because I was like, well, why would you want, I'm like, the guy's there. Like, I'm just going to be doing an impression of him.
Yeah.
And it took me a lot of years to feel like I had my own voice enough in it to be like, oh yeah, okay, well, this is my version of it. Even if that guy's sitting right there, this is my thing. Because I feel the same, another, like, Post Malone, like that Finer Thing solo. That was another thing that, like, I still feel like I got. I mean, that record came out a year ago and I still have people tagging me over the.
Very Brent inspired.
Yeah. And, you know, again, that's just one of those licks that, like, somewhere along the lines I learned, and it, in my haze of. It was probably 5:30 a.m. and we'd been tracking for 14 hours with Post, and he was like, D-Wells, we just play another one, play it even crazier, and just playing all the notes all over the thing and thinking like, oh, that's hilarious. And you know, and then it becomes one of the things that you know, people are tagging you in videos on and stuff. It's pretty funny to me.
Yeah, though, right, so. Right. Okay, last session to call out. You played on a Fast Car, Luke Combs.
Yeah.
This is super, like, really not a crazy guitar record. Very subtle. You played it with Rob McNally. Both you guys are on guitars.
Yeah.
So do you remember
one of my favorite guitar players?
Unbelievable. Do you remember, like, what the communication was between the two of you, or did you, like, it's hard to know who plays what on that record. So do you remember what you played?
Yeah, I remember what I played, because it's, like, not even really guitar. It's what people think is the steel on that record. Because, you know, and that's, you know, I think, especially as I started producing records, you know, I started looking around the room a lot more and being like, okay, what's covered here? Like, what's my role? And I also think that on any instrument, we're talking about just the session ideology, if you will, or whatever. Like, I think that one of the hardest things that I had to learn as a player and that I see other people struggle with is learning what to do when the song isn't really for you. Like, if you're a great guitar player or you're a great piano player, like, it's probably some of the easier work when something's like really lobbed up at you. If someone's like, hey, we want it to be this piano led thing, and it's like, think like Walking in Memphis or like, what, I mean, whatever, but it's like, oh, okay, well, I know what to do. Even if the execution is a challenge or whatever, like, you feel like you know what to do. But man, when someone brings you a song that's just like not a rocking guitar thing or whatever, or not some, you know, R&B thing where you know to go to the cliches or whatever, it's like, that's the stuff that can be challenging. And I was really fortunate in my early session career, like when I was getting, pretty good, but I started working with a lot of like young singer-songwriters that were doing a lot of like mellow music. And, you know, I always loved records like that Sean Colvin, the Sonny Came Home record, that Few Small Repairs. And then the next, I mean, I'm a huge John Leventhal fan. And like, I just thought those are always like such, like it's like a masterclass in like adding value to those tracks without overpowering the track. And so, yeah, you know, one of the skills I kind of developed, I guess I'd say, is just like finding this space when you look around the room and you're like, okay, well, the acoustic guitar is playing the thing. And, you know, I look over at Rob and, you know, I don't know what guitar he was grabbing or what, I can't remember where he started, but I probably just thought like, well, Rob's going to play something awesome. Why don't I just stay out of the way? And at that point, you know, you are, this is such a bad habit, but, you know, you're literally just, you know, and you're just doing stuff like that, and, you know, probably had some delay and some atmosphere, and you're just trying to be a guy, you know, that's, you know, and then, like, impact stuff at the top of the courses. But that's the kind of stuff that, you know, you just have to pick your spots and you find little lines to double. I mean, I'd have to hear the track again, but there's probably a couple lines that I grabbed with acoustic, you know, and it's like, it's really more like you're in an overdub mentality, like just trying to find some gaps. I can't remember who said it. We always say like, add value. Like,
yeah,
just trying to add value to the track.
Does anyone call you out with that part and go, that's it? Or do you know it's a good part because nobody says anything?
Honestly, more the second. Because it's typically like, you might get something where they'll go, yeah, like, Derek, that ambient stuff is great. And you just take that as like, okay, cool. And then I'm going to self-govern. At least that's the way I work. Then it's like, I'm going to craft, like, you've told me you're good with this in concept. So then I'm going to craft it the way I'm hearing it and get a take that I feel good about. And then if you've got, obviously, like, if they want me to change something or wanted to go higher on the bridge, I mean, I don't know, one of a million things. Like, I'm going to obviously honor that, those requests, but... Once somebody just kind of goes, yeah, we love that thing you're doing, and then, hey, hey, Jimmy Lee, then I just go, okay, then they said I'm good, I'm just going to figure this thing out. But yeah, just kind of like using slide as an atmosphere and it not it being like overtly slide, like it not being like Allman Brothers, you know, you know, just using it as a texture with verb and delay and stuff and using it as a texture, and it's like, almost like faux pedal steel thing. And I will do that sometimes. Like I've got guitars with palm benders and stuff, and I will actually play some steel licks in there. But, you know, I always say I'm like poor man's Dan Dugmore.
Yeah.
Great, great steel player. But yeah, that's really all I did on that track. And I might be lying, but I feel like then maybe I also played a baritone part on there where I was just like, okay, like all the mid range is covered here. But this might be an extra, you know, joke, a country insurance. Like, here's one more thing to lean it towards a Luke Combs record.
Yes, right.
Stylistically. And if you guys mute it, you mute it. But I probably would have done those
just
two
take
things.
It. You might as well have it.
Yeah, a little tremolo baritone. Never hurt anybody.
Okay, we're wrapping up with Derek Wells. Derek, you're a big watch guy. My problem with watches is whenever I feel like I might have enough money to buy a cool watch, I feel like I just end up buying gear or another guitar or something instead.
It's real. It's real.
So what's the compromise? Any cool, affordable watches, or what mentality should musicians have who also are interested in watches?
Listen, I have the exact same mentality about watches that I do guitars and amps. And it's this. It's like, if I like it and it's inspiring to me, that's enough. And like, I have literally like $200 guitars. Like the every guitar, every electric guitar part on the song My Church by Mary Morris was literally a $200 Guyatone guitar. That's the slide parts, everything. It's like, I've got super cheap instruments that I've bought out of pawn shops and stuff. And it's like, yeah, I also happen to have some nice ones, but like, that's not the point to me. It was like, it wasn't, well, I'd like to play guitar, but I can't afford a $5,000 guitar, so I'm not going to play guitar. And it's like, watches to me are the exact same thing. And it's like, you know, I have $99 G-Shocks that I love. I'm a big Seiko guy. I love like Seiko mods and Seiko sports. The Seiko sports series, Seiko 5 series are like $200 watches, and they're awesome.
Why do you like them? They look cool.
They scratch an aesthetic to me. You're getting a lot of watch for the money. I mean, they're like an automatic movement. The waterproof is great. I mean, some of those watches are more waterproof than like really expensive watches. And I'm also I'm a big like brand history guy in general. Again, with guitars, like I like to know the story. Like it's a Silvertone amp. Like why, you know, I like to know the story in these kinds of things, and that to me adds value. And so like, whether you're talking about like Hamilton watches, like the Hamilton Khaki Field, which is like a super, you know, you can get, especially secondhand, you can get those watches for a couple $100, $300. And that's like an amazing, like American brand, but made with Swiss parts. Like that was the watch every like officer would have had in World War II from America. And like, that's the kind of stuff I just think is so cool. And so, yeah, it's like, you know, I've been lucky enough. I've had some milestones and I've like, you know, got some kind of pricier watches. But like, if you're like wanting to start with watches and you're thinking about it, it's like Seiko, Casio, Hamilton are like three of the brands I send everybody to, because they're like a lot of watch for the money. They're cool. And like a real watch guy would be like, man, awesome G-Shock. Like I'm in this watch thread with these guys and like, literally dudes with like $80,000 watches, and then they're like wearing this G-Shock at the pool today. It's like watch, it's like with guitars, like real recognize real, like a real guitar dude would think like your Harmony Saturn
that's
is cool.
That's what I want in a watch.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah.
You get a Seiko or a Hamilton or a Casio, and like a real watch dude would be like, hey,
yeah.
Sick.
Okay, last question here.
Yeah.
I've seen you call something out in a baritone you have, where you have like that classic Dan Electro baritone that everyone has, and you swap the bridge, which gives you like a more direct tone.
Yeah.
If you watch your rig rundown, you can figure out exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Any other like cool little gear hacks or anything, could be super random, anything like that just calls out to you as something like that. Like I watched that video and I was like, oh, that's so brilliant. I should get one of those bridges for my baritone.
Well, and just briefly, right. I mean, I think I said it in the thing, but that's Jeff Sin, the of Original Sin Guitars. That was his brainchild. Like he thought of that, fabricated it, and he was like, hey, I'm making these things. It really helps a lot. So I mean, I just took his advice and did it, and it's real. Man,
I'm putting you on the spot here with this. I didn't prepare you for this question.
I want to have a good answer too. I'm like looking at this. Like, is there something I can tell people?
Or pedal wise, you've got a rehoused Mastortion.
Yeah,
the board.
I mean, I think that there's some like.
Well, here's something interesting too. The way you rig your volume pedal is backwards, right?
The volume pedal is right. My expression,
your expression pedal
is backwards. Yeah, and that's a stupid thing too, because literally all that was because the mechanisms in these would go like I'd be on a floor and the drums would be hitting real hard and this would start to fall and it would be engaging the effect. So I realized really quickly, if I want to make engaging the effect foolproof, the resting position needed to be down. So
that's a good tip.
That was one of mine. But man, I would just say in general, like, tuning. Okay. I mean, here's one. This is like not a sexy one. No one's going to
give us the functional non-sexy tip.
Well, the reality is if you're going to tune a string, you know, you got to, to me, you have to tune it two ways. And I use strobe tuners. I think they're more accurate. It's also the big reason I switched to 11s, because like, I just feel like I did that well over a decade ago, but I just feel like the tuning was always more stable.
Really?
On 11s than 10s. And not that I'm super heavy-handed, but I just always felt like the tuning was more stable on 11s and 10s, including the intonation. But I always say, like, really whatever tuner you've got, like, you have to understand the part, and you need to learn, are you tuning to the spike or are you tuning to the dip? And what I mean by that is, like, when you strike a note, you're going to watch your tuner go, you know, right? And if I'm playing a part that is more like, I'll say bloom, for lack of a better word. If I'm playing a part that's going to feel more like this, like, and it's real sustained, right? I'm way more inclined to tune to the dip, which means you hit the string, and even if it hits a little sharp, but it settles flat,
that's what you want.
That's what you're looking for.
Yeah.
But if I'm going to tune to the thing, because that's really what you're going to be.
That percussive note has to be in tune.
And I don't care if it falls flat after that. Like, I don't want it to be sharp when I hit it. So, like I would say, like,
how do you tune to that, though? Will you just tune a little flat?
Well, I just make sure that what I'm gauging in tune is the first thing it hits.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Where, like I said, if I was tuning for a part like this, if I hit the G string and it goes just a hair sharp and then flattens, like, that's fine. Because I want the sustained note to be the one that sits in tune, right? And then if, I just know if I'm going to, I make sure and tune to the spike, you know? And so this is the level of nerd.
This is why you're the guy, though.
That I exist in.
Yes,
is
the, yes, yes.
Tuning two ways. And I also never quit tuning. Like, ever. If I'm not playing the part, I'm tuning. Like, all the engineers in town know, like, every time we get a new, like, assistant at one of the studios and we're about to kick off a song, you know, I'm still tuning during the drum count. And the guys that have worked with me for a long time know I'll hit the downbeat. But the new guys are like, I'll look up, I'm like, why have we not started? And I'll look up and they're staring at me and I'm like, dude.
Who's a new guy? Anyone super young that is making the session rounds and is showing up on sessions that's killing it right now?
On guitar specifically?
Or anything. Maybe guitar, but it could be anything.
Man.
Like, any really new cats in the, right now that weren't even doing sessions like a year ago? You could say no too. I feel like
Nathan Keeterly. Nate, who I've only met a couple times actually. And I've never gotten to work with, but I've heard some stuff. He's played on some records. And he's a great dude. Love him to bits. And I got some sessions last year from a project that I was doing production stuff on, and he had played some guitar on the demos and stuff, and I just thought, like, man, this guy's great. Like, got a handle on all. And you know, taste is so subjective, right? It's like, Nathan Keeterly is a guy that I really like in the electric guitar chair. And I mean, there's so many great ones, but he's definitely on like the newest tip, I feel like, for what we do, and also playing on some important records. So love that dude. Love his playing.
Check him out. That's a good answer.
Yeah, he's great. Yeah, yeah. Great dude, man.
That's awesome. Derek Wells. Mm. Dude, thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, of course,
coming onto the show. We'll do it again.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me, man.
Absolutely. Cheers. Did we leave anything out? Anything we didn't say that we should have said?
No. We're good. Last four digits of my social art now.
We'll take them. We got it. Cut it. Mitch, thank you, sir.